Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features the story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Mutale. The music in the background is Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley and the Wailers. Today, Africa Now explores the story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, formed in the auto plants in Detroit in 1968. Guests include Jerome Scott, a former auto worker, labor organizer in Detroit auto plants, and member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and Walda Katz Fishman, a scholar activist and professor of sociology at Howard University. Here is Africa Now's executive producer and co-host, James Pope, with the conversation.
On May 2nd, 1968, 4,000 workers in the Hamtramck auto plant in Detroit walked out against a speed-up, an increase in the speed of the production line. Several black strikers met in a bar across the road and founded the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, DRUM, to organize black workers. 2 months later, they organized their first wildcat strike. DRUM inspired similar groups at other plants, and these groups later came together to form the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. The LRBW was formed as an overarching umbrella organization that brought together various local struggles known as the Revolutionary Union Movements, or RUMs, in the automobile plants of Detroit and other workers' groups. Composed of black workers, they adopted a Marxist orientation combined with black nationalism. Forming in 1968 and lasting until about 1973, they were able to organize a vast number of workers to fight for their collective interests. They did this by developing what would be called a pedagogy of revolution, where the evolution of worker consciousness was raised to the level of critical consciousness. And for the LRBW, this meant developing a process that merged class consciousness with a revolutionary consciousness as they engaged in practices that spread the idea of struggle to other workers. The struggle of the LRBW was centered on the political development of black workers inside the development of global capitalism in the United States and within a leading sector of capitalist production in the early and mid-20th century, which was then the auto industry. This socioeconomic location molded a section of black workers into working class revolutionaries. The historical moment that shaped LRBW was located at the nexus of the post-World War II capitalist expansion and the beginning of capitalist globalization rooted in the new technical evolution of the forces of production, a turn to industrial automation of the workplace. The very process of their pedagogy of revolution was their study of theory and what was produced when this theory was applied to real-world experiences, which shaped their practice into workers' power. To study the intellectual processes of the LRBW in the context of a developing global capitalism, as they are identifying a pedagogy of revolution, is an essential frame of reference that can offer contemporary working class movements a guide of action. Meaning, the point of discovering the intellectual processes, theoretical development, of the LRBW opens space for us to understand the processes of how and in what ways they were intent to developing a workers' movement. As we pay attention to their ability to identify and name the world around them, and the steps they took to engage their realities in a larger context is an important point of entry to building working class unity. This development, seen as a process, serves to situate them historically while guiding us to identify what to extract from their practice that can be applied to the static and evolving conditions workers find themselves in today. What questions were left for us to take up? What are the contours of their thought and practice that can be extended and expanded? What are the similarities and dissimilarities in the conditions that workers find themselves across sectors today? And what is to be done? The LRBW is an interesting and complicated expression of the relationship between black workers in Detroit and the global capitalist system. It was a struggle between auto workers, the union, and the automobile industry. It encompassed the struggles and contradictions between the workers and the bosses, as well as between workers and the union of which they were a part. This period exposed the glaring internal and external contradictions of racism within and around the workers' movement, historically and in that moment. Yet, the LRBW was able to develop a process of struggle combining both theory and practice. This is their unique contribution to history and to revolutionary social movements, an exemplar of what happens when a movement meets the spontaneity of the moment. Although other studies have documented the LRBW in a historic manner and attempted an analysis of the organization, the recent book titled Motown and the Making of Working Class Intellectuals, The Story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, provides a more comprehensive view of the people, the movement, and the organization itself. In answering the question, what is the League of Black Revolutionary Workers and where did it come from? John Watson, in a 1971 interview with Radical America, gave this answer. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers is a federation of several revolutionary movements which existed in Detroit. It was originally formed to provide a broader base for the organization of black workers into revolutionary organizations than what was previously provided for when we were organizing on a plant-to-base basis. The beginning of the League goes back to the beginning of DRUM, which was its first organization. The Dodge Revolutionary Union movement was formed at the Hamtramck assembly plant of the Chrysler Corporation in the fall of 1967. It developed out of the caucuses of black workers which had formed in the automobile plants to fight increases in productivity and racism in the plant. With the development of DRUM and the successes we had in terms of organizing and mobilizing the workers at the Hamtramck plant, many other black workers throughout the city began to come to us and ask for aid in organizing some sort of group in their plants. As a result, shortly after the formation of DRUM, the Eldon Axle Revolutionary Movement, ELRUM, was born at the Eldon Gear and Axle Plant of the Chrysler Corporation. Also, the Ford Revolutionary Union Movement, FRUM, was formed at the Ford Rouge Complex. And now we have two plants within that complex organized. In relation to a shift in organizing objectives, specifically, quote, expanding its organizing activities to other areas, such as hospital workers and printers, who were being organized, as well as the United Parcel Workers Black Caucus, which is one of the League's affiliates, Watson summed up their efforts as a, quote, shift from community organizing and the organizing of, quote, street brothers and sisters and the black lumpen proletariat to what he articulates as a sharpening of their practice. In the interview, Watson outlined this further, quote, our analysis tells us that the basic power of black people lies at the point of production, that the basic power we have is in our power as workers. As workers, as black workers, we have historically been and are now essential elements in the American economic sense. Therefore, we have an overall analysis which sees the point of production as the major and primary sector of the society which has to be organized, and that the community should be organized in conjunction with that development. Watson goes on. This is probably different from most analyses which say the primary objective is to, quote, go out and organize the community and to organize the so-called, quote, brother on the street. It is not that we are opposed to this type of organization, but without a more solid base such as that which the working class represents, this type of organization, that is community-based organization, is generally a pretty long, stretched out and futile development. Writing in Motown and the Making of Working Class Intellectuals, The Story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, Jerome Scott and Walda Katz Fishman highlight General Baker's assessment of the objective forces and the subjective understanding of the base to analyze the difference between the spontaneous movement and the development of organization that reflected the changing conditions, that is, of the political economy and its impact on the realities of the workplace and the community. General Baker explained, quote, there's a difference between a movement and an organization. A movement breaks out spontaneously. Movements broke out at all the factories and other workplaces like the Detroit News, a major Detroit newspaper. Organizations are always running, trying to catch the movement and the motion. It's an important lesson that movements are spontaneous. They break out. Be prepared so when you see them, you can take advantage of them. That's the way history poses itself for us. It is vital at this point to point out that the process of consciousness formation cannot happen in great leaps without study, not simply reading. One's consciousness does not move based on the ability to quote lines of radical thought as if they are scripture and then applied for the justification of some uncontextualized point you're trying to make, but studying into practice. study to understand the objective conditions to develop an analysis that leads you and us to ask more questions. A process captured in the continuity of studying, practicing, assessing, repeating. Jerome Scott offers his reflection on the role of education in their political work from the perspective of the workers. Quote, "We began to think about what kind of program should we have? What kind of theory is the theory that most relates to what we are doing? We ended up with Marxist-Leninism as the theory that relates most closely to our lives. We were production workers. Marxism was written for workers. So from that perspective, it was easy to understand. What was not easy to understand is that this education process for many of us was brand new. For myself, I spent most of my life working off gut instinct. It had nothing to do with any understanding of what was going on economically, politically, or globally. In our study, we began to see connections between the way the plant was run and why it was run that way, because they had to make maximum profit." Adding more on the role of political education and its centrality in organizing, Charles Simmons asserted that, quote, "Political education is more than an economic exercise. It is a tool of analysis and guide of struggle." Simmons goes on to suggest that, quote, "The study of social history is a lifetime struggle. We embarked on it and figured we had to learn continuously about what happened in the past, how to apply that to the present, and have a vision to the future. Study was a central part of our lives, but study always had to be connected with practice, with action. That distinguished us from the academic community, where you write a book about it, and that's it." Today, we explore the story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers with Jerome Scott and Walda Katz Fishman, authors of Motown and the Making of Working Class Revolutionaries, the story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Walda Katz Fishman is a scholar, activist, and professor of sociology at Howard University, a founding member and former board chair of Project South, Institute for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide. She is a contributing author or editor of popular education toolkits and books, including the United States Social Forum, Perspectives of a Movement, and the Roots of Terror. Jerome Scott is a former auto worker, labor organizer in Detroit auto plants, and member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. The founding director of Project South, Institute of the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide, he is a contributing author or editor of popular education toolkits and books, including the United States Social Forum, Perspectives of a Movement, and the Roots of Terror, amongst others. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Listen intently, think critically, act accordingly. I'd like to take the time to welcome you both, Jerome and Walda, to Africa Will Now Project Collective to have a very important conversation. And this program, as I probably should note, is a collaboration or partnership between the Southern Workers Assembly and Africa Will Now Project as well, where we are building political education, the relationship between study and practice. And there's no other experience are probably historical, but very, very important contemporarily than studying the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. I'd like to, again, thank you both for taking the time to join us today.
Very happy to be here with you.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So you all have produced, I'm very excited. You all have produced a very important, important work on the historical, you know, obviously more contextual. I don't think we can call it historical in the context of more of an analysis of a moment that can project and telescope into the future. Or really, how do we understand? How do we get to this moment? And also, what are some of the lessons and some of the ideas and concepts and struggles within the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, but also what the League of Revolutionary Black Workers was struggling against. And this is a very important moment, particularly as fascism has taken or is taking a root in our society. And the book I'm talking about is Motown and the Making of Working Class Revolutionaries, the story of the League
of revolutionary Black workers. There's so much here. But what I wanted to do is I've constructed our conversation around some themes that the book kind of explores in more detail. And, you know, political education, the role of students and youth, internationalism, class consciousness, organizational objectives, gender, race, class at the point of production, so forth and so on, you know, all of these things. And, but let's start here. Let's talk about the environment, that produced the league. And I guess we can go with Jerome and then, you know, Waldo will,
yeah,
we'll go from there.
Yeah. As you know, the 1960s was a turbulent decade of movement development. You know, the civil rights movement was on the wow. 1968 seen the world break out in struggle from Mexico City to Paris, you know, and students and workers throughout the world rebelling, mainly against the effects of the capitalist system, you know, and all its ramifications. And it was in this era that the League of Revolutionary Black Workers began to develop during that period of time of the 60s. In 1967 in Detroit, there was a rebellion. And the rebellion broke out, you know, because of a raid on an after hours joint in Detroit. But that after hours joint was full of auto workers. You know, people had just got off work and they come to have a couple of drinks before they go home, especially if they was working the midnight shift, you know, and the police would periodically crack down on these after hour joints. But that particular day, the workers just wasn't having it, you know, and so the rebellion broke out in 67. Now, the thing that the people who eventually developed and was part of the league, the lesson that they came away from that rebellion was that something was going on here. Because when, you know, the city was shut down, a curfew was on for everybody. But if you worked at the plant, at the auto plant or the rubber plant or the steel plant, they gave you a pass to walk through the streets and get to work, you know, and seeing and absorbing that really had an effect on the way we constructed and the way we understood the role that the league had. And, you know, because that made us realize that the workers had some power. You know, if they were willing to escort us to work during the city halfway burning down, that meant that there was something that we were doing that was really important to them. And we took that lesson and held on to it throughout the process of the development of the league. So that was the environment. So in 1968, DRUM, a Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, called the Wildcat Strike at the Chrysler Corporation. And that just set everything in motion. That first 1968 strike. I worked at the Chrysler Detroit Forge plant in Detroit, and a couple of us went over to Dodge, Maine to meet with folks and ask them what happened. You know, what are y'all doing and how can we get a part of this? And that was just an example of what happened in a number of workplaces throughout the city. And it wasn't just industrial workplaces. You know, it was distribution, UPS. We had a revolutionary union movement at UPS, at the U.S. Post Office, you know, various other industries that were popping up around Detroit. And it was on from then. You know, once DRUM jumped off, we started a RUM at Detroit Forge. There was a RUM at I think at our height, there must have been about 20 to 22 different RUMs that we had as part of the organization. But that was the environment. And so DRUM jumped off in 68, and then the league pulled all those RUMs together, as well as community organizing that was going on in the city, as well as students organizing that was going on, mainly in the high schools. You know, so we all came together in 69 and formed the League of Revolutionary Black Workers.
Thank you for that. Walter, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. Just a bit. In terms of the militancy and the political grounding of the comrades who became the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, we can't underestimate the importance of the South. Many of them had come from the South, first, second generation. You know, their parents and grandparents had lived during the period of the slaveocracy, right? And so they brought this intense understanding of the interrelationship of class exploitation, white supremacy, racial oppression, Jim Crow, and fascism. They really had experienced that in their lifetime, and it stuck with them, right, as they entered the plants in the North, you know, escaping to so-called, you know, better opportunity. The other thing about that moment, because I think understanding the history of fascism, the history of ongoing white supremacy and intense, you know, class oppression and exploitation, is the 101st Airborne tanks going down I-75 in Detroit. It was part of the effort of the state apparatus to quell this rebellion, which was multiracial, right? There are different comrades in the book who explain, you know, it's presented as always, it's a black, you know, a black uprising, but no, it was a class uprising that had black workers at the center. And so I think those were two pieces. One other piece is Cuba, okay? The Cuban Revolution was, you know, about 10 years earlier. And several of the comrades, including General Baker, who was one of the people that was picked up during the rebellion and sent to Iona or Jackson, one of the, you know, the prisons there in Michigan, they had traveled to Cuba and were deeply impacted by the Cuban Revolution. So it seems, you know, as Jerome said, this melding, right, this gumbo, if you will, of internationalism, of the slaveocracy of the South, and of the ongoing fascist rule in this country. And I lift that up because these are things that are with us today. And I think we have to explain, you know, why we thought things got better, and then why everything is just reverted to a very intense kind of fascism, which is attacking all workers. But again, black workers have historically been right at the center of this working class struggle.
And, you know, we talk about, and you know, Jerome, you write about this, and, you know, Walter, you put this, you know, kind of make an entry point into the relationship between race and class at the point of production. We're going to get there, because in order to understand how that oppression rising up, you're obviously from the South, moving, you know, to the North, the industrial North, that relationship becomes very important as well. Let's back up just a little bit. Sure. Because you bring a very important point of the movement from the South, right? People kind of couch this, and I want to hear, you know, your perspectives. This is an argument that I've been making, particularly in and out of the classroom, that to kind of describe the movement, particularly of Black folk from the South into the North, as a great migration, while that nomenclature, that particular title, kind of missed the point that it was war in the South, right? There was this, you know, so what happens when we look at that as a refugee crisis of Black folk moving from the South into the North, bringing struggle? Is that a kind of interesting, or, you know, you get what I'm saying? Like, what does that frame do? Because if I'm looking at the League and its development, I look at it as warriors and folk coming from the South into the North and bringing the struggle with them. You know, Walter, you can respond, and then Jerome, you know, as well.
Well, I would agree. The word migration, you know, is a bit mild for the kind of intense violence, right? That Black folk were living through in the South, a massive lynching and just the re-enslavement, if you will, you know, on what had been the slave plantations, right? And so it was of necessity. The other thing, though, that we need to hold on to is, what was Detroit becoming? Why was the industrial North Midwest this magnet? Okay. And partly Henry Ford recruited not only Black workers, but also international workers, particularly from the Middle East, right? There's a huge Middle Eastern and Palestinian community in Detroit that was in the plants at the time, because he thought that that would keep Black and white workers from organizing together. So I think it was more, you know, escaping the violence of really state terror in the South. I mean, that's what fascism is, right? That's what Jim Crow was, state terror in the South. And so, and then there were these opportunities but it's kind of necessity, you know? I mean, there's this sense of necessity and okay, so you go north. So I think that we should reframe this question. And I think also what the Southern experience means in the revolutionary process then, right, and now. Because in some ways it is multiracial, though Black folk are at the very, very center of it, right? It's also very patriarchal. I know we'll get to the gender question, but just to say that patriarchy, you know, and I mean, because the South was really the cauldron of the origins, right? I mean, at its inception, America is a Southern nation, with all the terror and horror that brings. So I think that, especially because you're working with Southern Workers Assembly, it's important for us to lift up the strategic location of the South in the revolution then and in the revolution now.
You make two points, and I definitely want, you know, Jerome to kind of, you know, kind of piggyback. What did that look like, particularly in the plant? But also, if you could wrap in your own experiences, you know, in war, like having this international context, because Detroit looked different. You had the Shrine of Black Madonna. You had, yes, community organizations. You had
Republic of New Africa.
That's right. You had talk of, you know, contextualize, you know, what Walda kind of laid out for us in that particular way for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I want to say is that, you know, immigration sort of indicate to people that people were making decisions, you know, to where to go. You know, let me, and planning to go somewhere. Well, I think most Black folks' experience was the same as my family's. You know, my grandparents grew up in Southern Georgia, and they were married and had seven children at the time. And some white man attacked my grandmother, and my grandfather defended her. Well, they made it home, and as soon as they got home, all the people told them, get on that train now. You know, we'll send the kids later, but you got to get on that train now. And I think that's basically the experience of most Black folks in terms of how they got away from the South. It was really a necessity to move away, because every time they stood up, their life was in danger. So I just wanted to make sure that people understood why we're having this discussion about migration and not the proper context to put it in. The thing about the South that I think people brought to the North was that sort of attitude that white supremacy is so bad that my life depends on what I do next. You know, and they brought that attitude to the plant, and, you know, and some of us went into the plant thinking that this is the North, you know. We ran away from white supremacy at its worst. But to find out in the plant, that was the number one complaint. you know, the way the foremans treated black workers, the jobs that we got, you know, it, the fact that we were the last hired and the first fired, you know, all those things that we experienced by going into the plant was just reflective of all the fights that was of such a high level in the South. And we felt like our job now is to take it to this high level into the point of production. You know, how do we take the demands of the civil rights movement to the point of production and be, you know, try to make sure that whatever happens in on Main Street as a result of this movement also happens at the point of production?
You are listening to a portion of a conversation between African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope and Jerome Scott, a former auto worker, labor organizer in Detroit auto plants, and member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Also in the conversation is Walda Katz Fishman, a scholar activist and professor of sociology at Howard University. The conversation explores the story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers formed in the auto plants in Detroit in 1968. The music in the background is Black Gold by Esperanza Spalding. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
So let's talk a little bit more about the role of the importance of political education, particularly you have all of these confluence of forces, right? You have a like nationalist strand. You have an unorthodox, as I call it, a religious development, particularly the nation and other particular formations, the shrine. Then, of course, you have workers who are in the center of this, navigating these particular spaces, navigating the racism of the unions, navigating the racism on the streets of the police, of the communities. Talk a little bit more about what did a political education, how did that look? What would that look like? Because again, in order to have a unity or class consciousness, particular workers' class consciousness, you, of course, Du Bois talks about white worker, black reconstruction. So there's a lot of confluence of forces here. And what was the thinking into that particular process? Also, one last thing, you had an international. You had folk, concerned with Palestine. There was anti-colonialist movements happening. I know I threw a lot there. So, you know, Jerome, you can respond and then Walter follow, you know, just flow, just come right on in. I'm going to turn my mic off and hear you talk.
Well, first of all, the political education, the League from its very beginning had people who were studying, Marxism as the main sort of, theoretical process that they were studying. That process basically for the first couple of years of the League did not penetrate down into the rank and file yet. Not the first couple of years. But I mentioned that the leadership had studied because, like Walter was saying earlier, part of that leadership had went to Cuba. You know, but also part of that leadership had also been to the Middle East. And you know, the conversations that we would have at meetings would not only talk about what's happening in the plant and all that, but reports would be given about what's going on with the Palestinian struggle. You know, we hadn't studied the Middle East, but we got information about what was going on a pretty regular basis, because parts of the leadership were not only studying that, but participating in those struggles. You know, so we got an internationalist flavor to our political education from the beginning. Now, what made the rank and file begin the process of political education in earnest was that after a couple of years, we did an evaluation of our work, you know, in the plant. And we found that we had made a lot of advances. You know, we had people who were elected to union positions of steward, and some people who were elected to the International Council of the Union and all that. And the same thing on management. You know, we had managers hired and so on and so forth. But then when we looked around, the life that we had to live at work was still the same. You know, it hadn't changed. The white supremacy was still there. The health and safety issues were getting worse all the time, you know, and so we began to think that something we needed to think about what we were demanding if we were getting positive results, but not the kind of changes that we needed. And at the same time, there was these internal struggles going on within the league that pushed us toward the need for political education, because it eventually became those struggles eventually became the basis of a split within the league, you know. And so there was various forces forcing us toward trying to get a better understanding of what's happening in the world. And so once the split happened and we found ourselves, you know, the split went along the lines of most of the workers in the plant and most of the community and student organizations stayed with the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Some of the community organizations and some of the national contacts that had been developed around the league went with the organization that was being called the Black Workers Congress. You know, and three people from the executive committee went with that, and four people from the executive committee went with the league. You know, so it was a pretty significant split. We decided that we needed to understand the world better because we needed to develop a better program. I mean, that was really the essence of it. We realized that our organizing work was good, but our political understanding of where we should be concentrating and what kind of work we should be doing in those plants might need a different sort of thing to it that we hadn't done. And so we went on what ended up being about an 18-month educational retreat in which most of us studied at least 3 or 4 hours a day. Like, I worked midnight shift, and I would come from work to the office, and about 20 to 25 of us who worked midnights would come together every day after work, and we would collectively study, which I think is really critical, the collective study of Marxism. You know, because everybody talks about how difficult Marxism is, and really, it was written for the workers. You know, I mean, when you really get down to it, it was written to try to give the workers the kind of information that we needed to really understand the capitalist system and understand where our blow should be pointed at. You know, and so to us, that was the most important thing. That the better you understood this world, the better organizer it would make you, you know, and I believe that's what kept us going. That's what kept us studying, because we realized that we were unfolding concepts of the capitalist system that we had never considered before. You know, like, for instance, we were unfolding that white supremacy was not just an oppressive system. It was also very profitable. You know, they profited from white supremacy. That white supremacy enabled their exploitation to be more intense. You know, that black folks were not just hated. You know, I mean, that wasn't the core of it. The core of it was we could be exploited, and we could be exploited even more than white folks. You know, and so that hatred was the basis for setting the condition for the exploitation. And I could go on and on and on about the concepts that we unfolded that we just had never conceived of before. But that's the thing that kept us going. And that's the thing that made us realize that political education has to stick with you throughout the development of this struggle, because things change every day. Mm-hmm. And you cannot rely on what you studied in the 60s and 70s to solve the problems that we encountered in 2025. You know, there's some similarities that we understand, but the totality is really different. And we have to be able to apply our understanding to this reality and not the former.
Please, Walter, if you wanted to add, you know, add into this, because of course you were at Wayne State at during this particular time, right?
I was at Wayne State. It was the first time I was exposed to Marxism. Mm. I went to elite Southern University, Tulane, and you know, sociology. I mean, there was no Marxism. And so when I got to Wayne, it was 68, okay? That was the year. I didn't know the League comrades, right, directly, but like I said, they had taken over the South End Press, right? I mean, Wayne State was a League of Revolutionary Black Workers campus, okay? And I just hadn't gotten acclimated yet. But this sort of, you know, revolution and working class struggle and black struggle and anti-Vietnam War struggle, it was in the air. But as a sociology student, grad student, we read Marx. And, you know, when I read it, I said, oh my God, that explains my life. That explains New Orleans and Jim Crow, right? That explains the difference between the reality of the world and the way it is presented to us, the way, you know, people want it to appear. And so I think that, for me, it was essential in how I eventually joined the journey during the period of the Communist Labor Party, which was in the 70s, which was the next formation, so to speak. But I also think that when we interviewed the 40 plus folk, right, that we interviewed for the book, the one thing, wherever they moved politically, the one thing that they all said was that this political education, one, kept them grounded, two, kept them from burnout, right? I mean, political education is essential for us to really understand the process of revolution, right? And so it was really a critical tool and remains one. And I think for, you know, those two kind of essential reasons, one, it helps us understand the changes that are happening and that even, you know, when we're further along in the revolutionary process, things will always continue to change, right? I mean, change never stops, right? It's the continuous piece. And to understand the centrality of living in a capitalist society in which there's only one choice of what class is going to be able to control it. You know, I mean, that's very clear in Marxism. It isn't so clear in a lot of other theories. And it's to understand, which the League also came to understand, the multiracial, multigender, and international quality of, and intergenerational, you know, the multigenerational. And so in some ways, the League embraced all of that. It's really coming to the fore in this moment that when we talk about working class, people think, because people from my discipline, sociology, taught you that there is no class, right? But they think of working class as white people. And that is just totally wrong. And so it's part of that clarity that comes from the unity of struggle and study. And neither one of them alone is going to get us to where we need to go. And so that is just one of the biggest lessons from the oral history of the League, you know, is that this was really helping keep people grounded. Because we all live in an economy, no matter what we think our politics are. And one of the comrades said, he said, you know, I don't want to talk about power. I just want to talk about the economic foundation of society, you know, because that impacts all of us. And so I think that there are all of those, you know, kind of elements and bits and pieces that for us, I mean, Marxism puts it all together, I think, in a way. It's a holistic methodology of analysis, and it's a methodology of ongoing change. And I think of optimism, right? Yeah. And I think that that's really important to me as a theory. And for the comrades, it brought a great sense of we can win this in the right, you know, conditions, time, and place.
So the spontaneity.
I have just one more thing to that.
Please, absolutely.
Move on. Please. And
I mean, what we understood about Marxism is that it had to be applied to the real world. You know, it's not an answer to anything. It's an understanding of the conditions that you are surrounded with and gives you some indication of how you can understand those conditions better and therefore be able to struggle with them differently. And we found this to be true in our work in the plant. I mean, the fact that during that period of study, we studied the whole concept of class, you know, and looked at it from the wildcat strikes that we had as black workers and pulling out black workers and what that meant in terms of its effectiveness. And then once we went through that study and decided we had to reach out to all workers, not just black workers, and we ended up having a wildcat strike in 73, which were, you know, shut down the entire corporation of Chrysler for a week. And the Chrysler Corporation couldn't break the strike. The strike had to be broken by the union. The union, the international union, had to come into our plant, you know, the Detroit Forge plant. And basically, we had a fist fight on the picket line with the international union, which was the cause of breaking our strike. But that, you know, to be able to understand that, yes, we were effective as black workers and in calling for the wildcat strikes, and they were really good. But we were even more effective when we approached it as a, you know, working class revolutionaries reaching out to other people who would listen to us no matter what their color was. And we really understood that's what you have to do with Marxism as a theory. You have to apply it to the real world and the work that you're doing and see that it will improve the outcomes of that work.
And so the relationship between theory and practice is, this is one of the, you know, we talk about it, you know, even whether you're in the classroom or whether you're in organizing spaces. So obviously this moves into kind of like thinking specifically about the organizing practices of the league, you know, and how the relationship between political education and the development of consciousness, working class consciousness becomes important. Could you talk a little bit? You mentioned wildcat strikes. Could you talk a little bit more? And this is in the book. Let me also make sure I plug this. A lot of what we're talking about is in the book, y'all. When you, those of you who are listening, you
know, everything, so
everything,
far.
All of this. So, but could you talk a little bit more specifically about, you know, the organizing practices that you in your study became clear? Mm-hmm. Because I think it's important to understand the conditions. And there was something that was written in the book. You know, you said this as a quote for you in the book, talk about Marxism was wrote for working class people, right? But also there was something else in the book saying that the recreation of the league cannot be possible.
Yes.
Today. Right. So let's talk a little bit about the period, particularly of this study, and what led to the organizing practices of the league, and then kind of move into, I guess we can leave that question there for those who kind of listen. That mm-hmm. you can't take it linearly, right? We have to understand the development forces of history as we're moving forward, because we're in the 21st century. We're mm-hmm. in robotics, we're in AI, but there's still some similarities. But go ahead, talk a little bit more about what in the study did you look at Du Bois and Black Reconstruction mm-hmm. and say a general strike is going to be. How you get what I'm saying though? Go ahead.
Yeah.
We did look at Du Bois. And I don't think we actually understood the importance of the general strike back then when we looked at Du Bois. But Du Bois' Reconstruction and the defeat of Reconstruction was very, very instructive for us, because the Southern question was big, you know, in terms of our organizing. Because a lot of us were either first or second generation, you know, from the South. You know, and so the Southern question was something that we discussed all the time. Mm-hmm. And mainly we discussed it because we wanted to figure out how we could harness that resistance that had built up in the South and continued to build up, and those people that brought that notion of resistance with them to the North was in the plant with us. So it became a really important sort of inspiration for militancy, you know, and for fight back that people had experience with already. It wasn't a new concept to be dealt with. You know, so the Southern question was big in our operations. But the most important thing, I think, was that we sought to make sure that everybody in the plant knew what was going on in the plant. So we had a regular distribution of flyers that we produced ourselves. You know, every RUM or community organization or student apparatus produced their own literature, produced their own propaganda, you know. And that was important, too, because there was different things that was happening in different places that should be emphasized. You know, like in my plant, the main thing that we ended up emphasizing was health and safety, you know, because someone was getting hurt in the plant every day, you know, and so a lot of our literature was around that. So the question of the role that the South played in our organizing, the role that literature and propaganda played, was all supported through our education. And one of the things that I didn't mention before, when we were on our education process, we got some visitors that visited us in Detroit from Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. You know, because there was a big developing working class struggle in Ethiopia against Haile Selassie and that whole grouping. And a group of Ethiopian students that had been here in the United States studying was on their way back because the struggle was getting to a real height in Ethiopia, and they stopped in Detroit and stayed with us for about a month, you know, and studied with us.
Just been listening to a portion of a conversation that explored the story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers formed in the auto plants in Detroit in 1968. The conversation featured African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope with Jerome Scott, a former auto worker, labor organizer in Detroit auto plants, and a member of the League of the Revolutionary Black Workers. And also in the conversation was Walda Katz Fishman, a scholar, activist, and professor of sociology at Howard University. Jerome Scott and Walda Katz Fishman are authors of Motown, The Making of Working Class Revolutionaries, The Story of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. The full conversation will be available on African Now's SoundCloud page. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is We Almost Lost Detroit by Gil Scott-Heron. That's it for African Now for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shah Anana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly spotlighting the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Sojourner Truth with Nana Jainfi, which is followed by Combit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter, at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now's archived on iTunes podcast. And on SoundCloud, search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host, James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Koza and Fona Ngonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Oderson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave with a closing song entitled Wake Up Everybody by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes featuring Teddy Pendergrass, remembering the song's 50th anniversary, which was released in November 1975. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, November 12th. Here are some headlines. The House is expected by this evening to vote on a Senate-approved package that could end the shutdown, now in its 43rd day. The measure, which would fund most of the government until January 30th and extend funding for certain key programs, including SNAP and veterans benefits through the end of September, does not include a guaranteed extension of health care benefits. Instead, the bill only guarantees a standalone vote on the health care subsidies in December before the credits expire at the end of the year and send health care premiums skyrocketing. The bill is reported as almost certain to pass. In more news from Capitol Hill, House Democrats today released three emails in which convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein references President Trump. In 2011, Epstein wrote that Trump, quote, spent hours at my house, close quote, with one of his victims. Also among the documents is a 2019 message from Epstein to journalist Michael Wolff. Epstein wrote, quote, of course he knew about the girls, close quote. The White House responded to the release by accusing Democrats of selectively releasing emails and arguing that they, quote, create a fake narrative, close quote. Trump has fiercely denied any knowledge of the sexual abuse carried out by Epstein and his accomplice, Ghislaine Maxwell. The new emails are sure to question Trump's narrative of his relationship with Epstein. In other news, as more warships build up around Venezuela, Venezuelan President Maduro is building his own show of force, and U.S. action is prompting a series of quick reactions abroad. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
After the USS Gerald Ford, the largest warship in the world, entered the U.S. Southern Command, Maduro ordered mass mobilization in a show of resolve. In addition to normal mobilization and drills, the government has also called up the Bolivarian Militia, a massive 4-million-person force composed of civilians. The U.S. has been slowly turning up the heat on Venezuela since September 1st, when it launched its first strike on an alleged drug boat. Since then, President Trump has authorized CIA activity in Venezuela, deployed numerous warplanes and special operations units, and most recently, dispatched the USS Gerald Ford, all in the name of curbing drug traffic. The extrajudicial nature of the U.S.'s actions have drawn significant backlash abroad, enough to impact our intelligence network. Both the U.K. and Colombia have stopped sharing intelligence with the U.S. for fear that it will be used for deadly airstrikes. Both countries are U.S. allies with a stake in the region, so suspending intelligence sharing can only be seen as an act of severe disapproval.
And in more news, yesterday, hundreds of indigenous people attempted to push their way into the COP30 climate summit in Brazil, where they clashed violently with security. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
The summit is being held in Belém, Brazil, where the Amazon rainforest meets the Atlantic Ocean. The rainforest is home to the indigenous groups who protested yesterday, and they demanded freedom from resource exploitation, especially fossil fuels and lumber. Diplomats were asked to remain inside, and even some blood was drawn as protesters clashed with police. The group eventually departed, but many of their leaders were later interviewed and expressed outrage over the constant encroachment by greedy industries. the Brazilian government has been advocating strongly against climate change, but apparently not fast enough for those at immediate risk of losing their way of life. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at wpfwfm.org and WBAIFM.